Okay, you're listening to Radioactive San Diego. This is DJ Rocky Magnolia here with some special guests in the studio this evening. SDSU Professor Hal Jaffe, who has written a number of amazing books, such as Sex for the Millennium, Straight Razor, 15 Serial Killers, and is actually here tonight to talk about his latest book, Beyond the Techno Cave, A Guerrilla Writer's Guide to Post-Millennial Culture. I've asked Hal to read one of his performance pieces that I found particularly powerful, entitled Death in Texas, this evening. Patrick Aysen will be doing the electronic accompaniment, and Joe Kane will be assisting with the reading of this piece. Thank you all for being here tonight, and I'm going to welcome Joe to the microphone. Joe, come on in if you can squeeze by. Can you squeeze in?
Let's see.
Oh, no.
Hey.
All right.
Tell me when you're ready.
Death in Texas. Date of execution, March 3rd, 2004. Offender, Marcus Cotton, number 999252. County, Cherokee. Last statement.
Well, moms, sometime it'd work out like this. Love life, live long. When you're dealing with reality, real ain't always what you want it to be. Take care of yourselves. Tell my kids I love them. God is real. He's fixing to find out some deep things that are real. Bounce back, baby. You know what I'm saying. Y'all take care of yourselves. That's it, Ward.
Date of execution, July 28th, 2005. Offender, Virgil Ravenfeather, number 921338. County, Navarro. Last statement.
Only the sky and the green grass goes on forever. And today is a good day to die.
Date of execution, January 16th, 2002. Offender, Horace Allen, number 987225. County, Liberty. Last statement.
Members of Mrs. Lackey's family, like I said, I take responsibility for the death of your daughter in 1989. I'm deeply sorry for the loss of your beloved daughter. I'm a human being also. I know how it feels. I cannot explain and can't give you no answers. I can give you just one thing. I'm a give a life for a life. I'm not saying this to be facetious. I hope you all find comfort in my execution. As for me, I'm happy. That's why you see me smiling. I'm glad to be leaving this world. I'm going to a better place. I've made peace with God. I'm born again. I hope you get over any malice or hatred you feel. God bless all y'all. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see.
Date of execution, February 8th, 2003. Offender, Octavio Guerra, number 978923. County, Zapata. Last statement.
I want to thank my family for their help and moral support and their struggle. Would have been a whole lot harder without their love. Me, I'm just going back home. I'll see y'all one of these days. Just don't rush it. I'll be there always. I'll be watching over you. I love y'all, huh? I'll see y'all in Slayton, Texas. Dios te manda contigo mi espíritu, cuida mi familia. Pull the plug, Warden.
Date of execution, June 6th, 2006. Offender, Timothy Tilton, number 903826. County, Red River. Last statement.
I know you folks is here to find closure for the things I've done. There are no words to describe the pain and suffering you have went through all these years, and that is something that I cannot take back from you. I hope that Megan, if she's here present today, knows that today I hope you all get peace and joy. I'm sorry it has taken 14 years to get closure. If it would have brung closure or brung her back, I would have did this years ago. I promise. I didn't mean to inflict the pain and suffering on your family. I pray that she is safe in heaven. I pray that you find closure and strength. I'm sorry. I'm truly sorry. You all take care. Pastor! Tell Megan I'm sorry.
Date of execution, June 13th, 2001. Offender, Johnny Saginaw, number 999222. County, San Jacinto. Last statement.
I deeply regret what happened. I did not intentionally or knowingly harm anyone. That's it. And Diet Mao.
Vietnamese for, let's get out of here. Date of execution, May 24th, 2006. Offender, Jesus Aguilar, number 911383, County Gillespie. Last statement.
I would like to say to my family, I'm all right. Leo, ¿dónde está Leo? Está aquí, Leo. Don't lie, man. Be happy. Are you happy? Are you all happy?
Date of execution, September 27th, 2004. Offender, Dwayne Earl Clapp. Number 999150. County, Scurry. Last statement.
Charla Lamar. Sonny Michelle. You all know I love you. Tell everybody I said, hey, I love them and I'll see them on the other side, okay? Now I just pray that if there's anything against me, that God will take it on home. I don't want nobody being mad at nobody. I don't want nobody being bitter. Keep clean hearts and I'll see you on the other side, okay? I love y'all. Stay sweet. Kick the tires and light the fire. I'm going home to see my infant baby girl and my mom.
Date of execution, August 14th, 2002. Offender, Javier Suarez. Number 944906. County, Palo Pinto. Last statement.
First of all, I'd like to apologize to family members of the Cadena family for whatever hurt and suffering I caused you. I hope you find it in your heart to forgive me. The peace you find will be a temporary peace. True peace will come only through Jesus Christ. I pray through this execution that you will find the peace you seek. Give yourself to Jesus. I thought about your loved one a whole lot. He will be in heaven waiting on me. I will then talk to him personal and ask for his forgiveness. To my family, I thank you and love you for being there for me and supporting me. Forgive me for the pain I caused you.
Spanish.
To all the people of Mexico that supported me, I carry each and every one of you in my heart. If you are going to demonstrate, I don't want you to do nothing crazy to these people. They are good people. They have suffered enough. Long live Mexico.
Date of execution, May 28th, 2002. Offender, Napoleon Beasley III, number 999141, County Rockwall. Last statement.
The act I committed to put me here was brutal and senseless. But the person that committed that act is no longer here. I am. I'm not going to struggle physically against these restraints. I'm not going to shout, use profanity, or make threats. Understand, though, that I'm saddened by what is happening here tonight. I'm disappointed that a system supposed to protect and uphold what is just can be so much like me when I made the same shameful mistake. I'm sorry that John Luttig died. And I'm sorry that it was something in me that caused all of this to happen to begin with. Tonight, we tell the world that there are no second chances in the eyes of justice. Tonight, we tell our children that in some instances, killing is righteous. There are a lot of men like me on death row, good men, who fell to the same misguided emotions. Give those men a chance to do what's right, undo their wrongs. A lot of them want to fix the mess they started, but don't know how. The problem is, the system is telling them there is no rehabilitation, only unforgiving punishment.
Date of execution, June 27, 2006. Offender, Angel Resendiz, number 922923, County Refugio. Last statement.
I want to ask if it is in your heart to forgive me. You don't have to. I know I allow the devil to rule my life. I just ask you to forgive me and ask the Lord to forgive me for allowing the devil to deceive me. I thank God for having patience with me. I don't deserve to cause you pain. You did not deserve this. I deserve what all I'm getting.
Date of execution, December 7th, 2000. Offender Claude Jones, number 980890. County Nueces. Last statement.
To your family, I hope this can bring some closure to y'all. I'm sorry for your loss, and hey, I love all y'all. Let's go.
Date of execution, May 17th, 2006. Offender Jermaine Heron, number 979210, County Potter. Last statement.
Mr. Jerry Nutt, I just hope this brings some kind of peace to your family. I wish I could bring them back, but I can't. I hope my death brings peace to y'all. Don't hang on to the hate. Mama, I love you. Lord, forgive me for my sins, because here I come.
Date of execution, May 28th, 2002. Offender, Adolf Wolfley, number 999666, County San Agustin. Last statement.
You gentlemen and ladies of quality, who frequently don't know yourselves what Christian virtue and justice are, look at the sunken, deep-set eyes of the lower classes, where you can see all too clearly the sorrow and misery that weigh on their hearts. Not everyone who sees his grieved and martyred face in the washroom mirror in the morning is a murderer or drug addict. On the contrary, The grounds for his misery are to be sought elsewhere. You friends near and far, if among you there is anyone without sin, let him come to me, and I will implore him for compassion and mercy.
Date of execution, April 20th, 2005. Offender, Troy Kunkel, number 954811. County, Angelina. Last statement.
I've been hanging around this popsicle stand way too long. Before I leave, I want to tell y'all. Bury me deep, lay two speakers at my feet, put headphones on my skull, and rock and roll me when I'm dead. I'll see y'all in hell.
Date of execution, August 23rd, 2005. Offender, Jimmy Blackman, number 924591. County, Hunt. Last statement.
This offender declined to make a final statement.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. That was a very moving piece that featured, if I understand correctly, the actual words of prisoners that were executed in the state of Texas?
Not the actual in every instance. I'd say that about 50, 60% of the words were actual. The rest were invented, and I reformatted a lot of the last statements. But it's primarily what the men on death row said, though not absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Still, you definitely gave a voice to a number of unrepresented people, and I find the piece really, really moving, and I can understand why you might alter it for performance purposes. What originally motivated you to write a piece utilizing the last words of executed prisoners?
It's some of the same motives I've expressed elsewhere, namely to try to look at people who are generally rendered invisible from the subject position rather than the object position. That is, to have them speak for themselves the best way possible. I've worked with Palestinian so-called suicide bombers and people who were accounted schizophrenic, and other people, homeless, who have been ghettoized and marginalized, so that we could hear whatever it is they want to tell people from their own words. I think that's crucial.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I agree with you. That is crucial. And you read words of people from a number of different cultural backgrounds. Did you find that challenging when performing Death in Texas?
I did. Actually, I even inserted something from somebody who didn't die in Texas, Adolf Wolfli, who was a brute artist. That is, an artist who was institutionalized for much of his life and was a painter, although very eloquent, but considered schizophrenic. It was challenging for a number of reasons. One is selecting the people. Two is getting them to talk without patronizing them, yet at the same time managing to insert whatever vernacular there might be in their talk. Because many of these men were on death row for 18, 20 years, and whether they were African-American or Mexican-American or white, they tended in some ways to sound the same way because they were interfacing with Texas guards and so on. But there were also differences. And I wanted to highlight the differences, but not to caricature the men. I didn't want to patronize or condescend to them. So that was difficult. and also moving my voice around, because I'm not an actor. You know, I'm a writer. Moving my voice around that way was challenging.
Well, I think you did an excellent job, and I think that you went about it in a very educated way. So I commend you. In doing your research for this piece, I'm sure you read many statements by executed prisoners, and I wanted to ask you if you could speak a little bit about the ones that you chose, and specifically why you chose them.
It's not easy to explain this absolutely. A lot of it depends on intuition. I wanted there to be, even though most of the inmates were either African American or Mexican American, obviously, I wanted to indicate that these poor people of color were the ones that were primarily being killed, though there were also poor whites and American Indians. I wanted there to be a range of people, some who were defiant, others who accepted Christ, others who, in a sense, were uncertain. I think all of them were, in a sense, uncertain, but more some more than others. I wanted to compose it the way one might compose a composition, so that it had at certain points, high points and modulation, and so it was a combination of things, both intuition, formatting, being faithful to the representation of those people who are actually on death row, not trying to make it into something it isn't. You know, the fact that most of the prisoners are African American and Mexican American, I didn't want to give readers or listeners the sense that it wasn't that. It was important they understand that. At the same time, I wanted there to be a kind of range in their feelings and expressivity.
Okay. And you end the piece by featuring an inmate who declined to make his final statement. What do you think is significant about that decision?
Resistance. Because resistance is, I think, a strong part of what I'm doing in my writing. It's one of the things I've maintained in different ways. I've even argued for using anger. In my disposition, as you know, I think, Crystal, is partly Buddhist. But at the same time, I've felt and feel that a certain kind of rage at the world is useful and not un-Buddhist. I think of those guardians of the Tibetans, the devotional spaces in Tibet, these angry Buddhas that guard this space, and so I see anger there. I think not to be angry is, in a sense, to avert your eyes. And that's something I just don't want to do.
I know that you've performed this piece in other places, such as San Francisco and SDSU. How do you think that it was received?
The response has been good, and people seem to be very moved by it. When we did it up in the Bay Area, there were a lot of questions afterwards, and people were very interested in hearing these words, it seemed. I tend to read them differently, depending on how I'm feeling and how somehow I'm sensing that they might respond. So there's a certain variability there. But I think the general sense of the narrative is always the same, a kind of elegy, elegiac, but also the feeling of dignity. You know, the fact that these men who've committed what's considered heinous crimes could be eloquent and moving and sensitive, I think somehow surprised a number of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And if you don't mind sharing, may I ask, What is your opinion of public execution?
I'm against executing prisoners. I'm against the death penalty.
Okay. And I thank you again for reading that piece. Again, I think it was really moving and a favorite of mine. However, I would like to change gears a little bit and ask you to speak a little bit on the behalf of your new book, which is the primary reason why I brought you into the studio this evening. So I'd like to ask you a few questions about Beyond the Techno Cave, A Guerrilla Writer's Guide to Postmillennial Culture. But first, I felt that your website did a really excellent job of concisely summarizing the book, which I myself have read recently. So I wanted to read a little bit of the blurbs from that website just to give our listeners sort of an introduction to what we're talking about. So the website describes the book as Harold Jaffe's creative nonfictions emerge from the underside. Their subjects are the unseen, unheard, unwired, unwitnessed in our society. They exist in the space inhabited by the caught breath, in that split instance when the mind tries to choose between fight or flight. Consider them testimonials to life in the pre-apocalypse. And then it goes on to describe the book as spanning between the years 2000 and 2006 and moving widely and effortlessly from art and technology in America to global politics, to travel in Asia, to writing in wartime, to gift-giving as a revolutionary act. Many of the texts read like formally innovative narratives, other function like conceptual art, remaining in the mind long after. Everywhere evident is Jaffe's broad erudition, social commitment, and energized, eloquent writing. And I thought that was very well put. And is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think that's complimentary enough.
Yeah. Okay, well, I have a few questions for you about that. Even in the introduction, the book is described as functioning as conceptual art. And to begin with, I'd like you to speak about that because it is actually a central theme in your current writing and within this book. And I would like to ask you to explain the concept of conceptual art for people who might not be familiar with the term and speak about why you chose to write in this genre.
I don't write in the genre exclusively, but I do sometimes. Initially, it was a term that was applied to visual artists exclusively in the 50s and 60s. And the idea was to move the object of concentration away from the object itself, from the image itself, and move it to the after image, so that it wasn't retinal art. It wasn't absolutely visual art. It was art which affected the mind in different ways. Aristotle speaks about drama when he talks about Oedipus as effecting a way for us to vicariously enact our emotions and to achieve a kind of purge or catharsis. It's almost like a kind of collective therapy. But there are other writers, particularly activists, social activist writers, of which Aristotle wasn't one, Brecht notably, but a number of people, who have spoken against catharsis and actually, instead of encouraging the reader to be purged, the idea is to encourage the reader to be pent. So instead of finishing feeling somehow virtuous because you've vicariously acted out these emotions with the characters on stage, the contrasting idea is to bring back this anxiety and this energy that hasn't been purged back with you, so you're pent up. So then it isn't the image that is primary, but is what occurs in the mind and the feeling and the heart, you know, after it's done and you go home and you try to sleep. So it's the after image rather than the image. Let me give you some examples.
Yeah.
Jenny Holzer is a visual artist, but she works with language a lot. And one of her first books was called Truisms, which was an alphabetical list of phrases and clauses which are not so much absolutely true as kind of cliche truths. And a few of them, they moved alphabetically, as I indicated. A few of them are private property created crime. Any surplus is immoral. Lack of charisma can be fatal. What she ended up doing is she put, she had one of these statements, private property created crime, actually mounted on a billboard and put in Times Square. So there it was, this anti-capitalist statement, right in the midst of selling Toyotas and cell phones and technology and so on, something very personal and a kind of indictment right in the middle of the groin of capitalist culture. I think that's an example of conceptual art. It's not the aesthetic appeal of seeing this billboard with these words on it, but it's seeing these words in the context of the other selling, of the actual selling, the actual attempt to sell, seeing these words in the groin of capitalism that forces you to think a little bit about it. Why capital would not even recognize it, why it was the money to mount the billboard that was primary rather than the actual words on it. It's almost as if they expect that if you're going to mount your work on a billboard or put it in a museum, immediately it becomes unrooted, immediately becomes bloodless. Once it's in a particular setting, it loses its blood, it loses its energy. And I think having those words in that setting forces us to think about it in a different way. That's one example.
Thank you for sharing that. No, I think that it's a good example that describes it well, and thank you for getting in depth with that. I appreciate it. Okay, well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your book, and I had a question for you about the docufiction Potlatch, which is a story about an individual who reclaims deserted buildings, such as a closed Burger King or an abandoned Rite Aid, and turns them into a place to feed the homeless for 23 days. In this story, a rather alternative definition of terrorism is offered by one of the characters. The gentleman being interviewed within the docufiction said, "Terrorism is a single individual feeding the homeless and almost homeless in the wealthiest country on the globe and having it labeled potlatch conceptual art by the Wall Street Journal." Would you label terrorism in this manner? And if so, could you explain why?
Yes, I think I'd label it that way. You know, the feeding the homeless, using buildings that are, as it were, anti-homeless when they were occupied, Walmart, Ralph's, The Gap, etc., and then using them to set up kitchens to feed the homeless is an interesting, I think, kind of reuse of these buildings. Doing it for 23 days, not having any kind of residue left except what remains in the stomachs of the homeless, this has been called a kind of art. And I think this is yet another example of conceptual art, because there's nothing there. There's no object there at all. Because once the artist, Rikrit Tiruvanaja, finishes, he gives everything away and he goes on to open up another kitchen to feed the homeless. I think it's the definition by the Wall Street Journal. What it does is it ghettoizes and marginalizes gift giving, and it turns it into a category. It tries to niche it, to put it into a niche instead of accepting it as a version of love, as a kind of agape, as the Greeks called it, a kind of giving, a kind of love that's equivalent to charity. That's really what it is. Mm-hmm. And for them to ghettoize it and to look for a category to fit it into, I think tries to strip some of the energy from it and to make it into some sort of special interest, you know, rather than something that isn't special interest, that applies to homeless people and people who are almost homeless across the world. And there are many millions of them. So, in other words, it's not the kind of terrorism definition that one sees. It's a kind of institutional terrorism that functions, I think, even more frighteningly. Although you have to think about it a little bit, you know, to recognize what it's doing, at least in the terms that I mean to represent it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'd like to change gears a little bit and talk about The Writer in Wartime, which explores the artistic and social differences between what you call engaged or autonomous writing. And I was going to ask you if you could explain for our listeners the difference between these two approaches to writing.
Well, in a time of crisis, engaged art, instead of turning its back or averting its eyes, addresses the crisis. Autonomous art, or art that takes itself as autonomous, whether it's writing or different kind of art, tends to avert its eyes from the crisis and turn instead to its own private problems and adventures. Hannah Arendt, who is a political philosopher, called this kind of faux autonomous writing inner emigration. She used as an example of the writers and artists who stayed behind in the Third Reich. They stayed in Germany, even though they knew that Nazi Germany was genociding people and was conducting this racial war worldwide, or trying to conduct it worldwide. The reason they stayed is they were profiting indirectly from it. They had decent jobs or good jobs. They were artists, let's say, and they were doing woodland scenes. So instead of leaving the poisonous country and speaking out against it, they emigrated in a kind of psychological way. She calls it inner emigration. They emigrated psychologically while actually still being there. They pretended they were elsewhere. That is to say, they averted their eyes. And they pretended that Nazi Germany wasn't Nazi Germany, so they could continue with their work. I think that autonomous writing, or writing that claims to be autonomous in a time of crisis, tends to do the same thing. One of the questions, of course, for Americans is what constitutes a crisis. Is the fact that Iraq is being genocided, and there was an attempt to do the same thing to Afghanistan that failed, does that constitute a crisis for us? The fact that 600,000 minimum of civilians in Iraq, including many, you know, thousands of children and pregnant mothers and old people, have been killed for no reason, because we know that the United States is getting ready to withdraw after the country has been completely flattened. Does that constitute a crisis for us? Now, one thing that did constitute a clear crisis for some people was the AIDS pandemic. And during that period in the 80s, a number of people, most of them gay, but not all of them, bracketed their writing, bracketed the work they were doing, and instead turned to fighting the, not AIDS itself, but fighting the propaganda that accompanied AIDS, because the propaganda was very toxic then. And tended to paint all gay people, particularly gay men, with the same brush, to demonize them, in effect. And it started with ACT UP and then spread to Grand Fury. And what they did is they, by bracketing and putting aside the work that they were doing previously, they directed their art as a kind of, they turned their art into a kind of crisis art. And they used their art as a kind of agitprop, as a kind of agitation propaganda, to give voice to those people who were suffering with AIDS, so they to fight this kind of demonization. That was a clear sense of a crisis, though not everybody joined it right away, because it was seen then, in the early days, as being exclusively a gay disease, rather than a disease that claimed many more people. So I think that autonomous art is actually, in many instances, not in every instance, in complicity with the dominant culture, even though it pretends to be objective and not to take one side or the other. By not taking a side in a time of crisis, it's in effect in complicity, is my point.
Mm-hmm. I think that's well put. How did the Nicaraguan novelist Claribel Alegría influence your opinion about engaged writing?
Well, Claribel Alegría was part Nicaraguan and part Salvadoran, and both countries were being strong-armed by the United States in the 80s. Nicaragua in favor of the Contras against the Sandinistas, and El Salvador in favor of the fascists, against those people who wanted to change the country so that poor people weren't completely disenfranchised. When I did an early issue of Fiction International, and I asked a number of writers, some activists and some not, whether they thought writing and art making can be useful politically and socially. When I asked Claribel Alegría whether it would be, whether a writer who was writing in Nicaragua about something other than the crisis that was gripping the country would be a writer that she'd respect, and she said no. And I said, what would you do if you would meet such a writer, assuming that you knew him beforehand? She said, I'd refuse to shake his hand. That's how much it meant to her. Now, I wouldn't refuse to shake anybody's hand necessarily, but I have a little bit of the same feeling about those people who argue without trying to understand, you know, what's at stake. Against artists taking hold and responding to crisis. You know, parenthetically, Crystal, you might wonder what advantage the artist has over other people in terms of responding. I think the writer cultivates consciousness and sensibility and is separated from, generally speaking, from how the majority of people think. I think the writer values dream space much more than other people do. I think the writer is also able to express herself or himself much more clearly. And I also, you know, and the writer, if he or she has achieved a certain status, can be recognizable. So if such a writer were to write on behalf of the oppressed, or to write an op-ed piece, or even to pay attention to the world outside his narcissism and sensibility, he or she might be able to articulate it with more clarity, feeling, and modulation than most people who aren't writers could.
Mm-hmm. I think new rhetoricians would absolutely agree with that, and as do I. In The Writer in Wartime, you discuss the benefits of writing from an autonomous perspective, and you speak of a colleague who was not able to have his work published because it was from an engaged perspective, and you also speak about the bias against political writing within the MFA creative writing programs. And I would like to pose the question to you, why do you think mainstream American literary communities are so afraid of engaged writing?
Well, it's sort of a complicated question, because when you look around at other countries, just to choose some at random, France, Germany, many countries in South America, think of Garcia Marquez in Colombia, Guatemala, there isn't this prohibition against writers writing about subjects outside the intimate confines of their consciousness. I think the idea, it's become institutionalized at this point because many young writers don't look carefully at the history of writing. If they did, they'd see that writing has been many different things. It's been devotional. It's been sponsored by patrons and as a result paid homage to royalty. But it's also been revolutionary. Think of the writing during the 30s. Think of the writing that accompanied the art and writing that accompanied the Spanish Civil War. I mean, there are any number of examples. Think of the writing about the Vietnam War. Think of the writing that's surely going to come out of the Iraq War. I think the universities now are very much like corporations. And if writers were describing a much wider arc in their work, I think they'd be much more dangerous than they are. Universities, many of them, are willing to give artists a place in the corner to pirouette and pee in, so long as they don't make trouble. But if they start speaking, if writers start writing and artists start painting and sculpting and doing things on their computer about how the United States functions vis-a-vis other countries and how it's been implicated in ethnocide and genocide and so on, I think it's going to make the corporate university, which functions hand-in-hand with the corporations which are partly or in good part responsible for this ethnocide and genocide, it's going to make them very uncomfortable. So they won't, in effect, tolerate it. Most people who judge writers who are trying to come into a program, that is to say, professor writers who are in place in a particular university, will almost immediately discount writers who are writing politically, unless it's a kind of sexual politics, unless it has to do with a kind of politics that's been segregated and doesn't necessarily have the broader implications that writing about countrywide crises would have. So that's how it functions. It's not that anybody is given the word. It's just been institutionalized. It's like people who work at a job. They're expected to do certain things and dress a certain way. If they deviate, this deviation is used against them. And I think it functions similarly in universities, whether it's somebody who teaches creative writing and writes in a certain way or somebody who teaches political science. They're expected to behave in corporate-approved kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perhaps that's one of the reasons why Homeland Security is now on every single campus in the United States. Okay, thank you for that answer. And within this particular docufiction, you state, and you sort of did a little bit within your previous answer, that almost without exception, every MFA program insists that its writers shun both politics, gender politics accept it, and linguistic or structural innovation. As a result, MFA fiction students everywhere write strenuously workshopped linear narratives which address love and family and betrayal and gender, themes from a restricted imaginary repertory. How do you, as an MFA fiction instructor, fight this sort of homogenization within creative writing programs?
Well, you were in one of my classes, Crystal, so you have some idea. It's not easy. I try to turn it back to the students themselves and to ask them the kinds of questions that would generate their real feelings, or rather than the feelings they have that are sort of officially approved. And I try to give exercises that will touch corners of their, you know, sensibility or consciousness which aren't usually addressed. It's like giving voice to the unvoiced with the Death in Texas piece. And it's also not being afraid to move laterally to use a class as a kind of session where there's a lot of give and take, and there's always a certain degree of improvisation. I think that classes have been legislated too strenuously, too strictly. I like the idea of moving laterally and getting a sense of the feeling in a class and going with that. I think it comes down to trying to empower students more, but in ways that really empower them, which allow them to speak and to write from areas of their consciousness which have previously been inhibited. That's part of what I do, and I do it differently. And part of it is done strategically. Part of it is done improvisatorily. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I myself really enjoyed your class, so I think it's working. And may I ask, what is your best advice for young guerrilla writers?
Not to avert their eyes. I think that's the best thing I could say. What they do when they turn toward a crisis, I think, is complex. And I would hope that what they would do would have to do with feel for the people who are being victimized or being used. But I think the first step is not to avert your eyes. Not to pretend that you're existing in a suspended state, that things go on as usual, but to pay attention to what's going on in the world at large, including in serious, grave, very grave environmental problems, the various kinds of genocide that are being perpetrated in our name for reasons that many of us don't agree with. So to put it succinctly, I would say the advice I'd give is don't avert your eyes.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to speak about another docufiction entitled The Airport that's also featured within your new book. And it actually reads like a cultural study of sorts in which you explore both consumer culture and post-9/11 airport bureaucracy through documenting a common airport experience. What point are you making about American culture in examining what you call these hyper-real global villages?
Yeah, I hear a part of the what I have in mind is to demonstrate how what some thinkers like Paul Virilio, who's a French thinker I like a good deal, what he calls motility, M-O-T-I-L-I-T-Y, how motility is replacing mobility. That is to say, how real time is now aping virtual time. We have people sitting at their console who are just moving their mouse and going from place to place. Instead of literally, actually going from place to place. So instead of going to Guatemala and experiencing something about how the campesinos and the poor Indians feel, they'll surf to a Guatemalan website or read some data about Guatemala. And we get that sense in airports. Airports have been so homogenized that when you walk from boutique to boutique, it's almost like surfing the internet. There's some of the same feel. There's no profile, really. There's a kind of flattening effect, but it's also hypnotic because of the sameness of it. And there are a minimum of smells. There's a minimum of sensory experience. It's almost all visual. And I think that's happening at airports increasingly. And it's happening also in countries increasingly. If you go to Singapore, for example, it's not so different from being, in L.A. In a certain way. It's different, but not that different. And the homogenization is taking hold. There are counter movements. One of the inadvertent counter movements, which has upset Europe a good deal, particularly Western Europe, is the fact that so many poor Muslim people have been migrating into Europe. If you look at the Netherlands now, or France, or the UK, it's a very different country physically now than it was 20 years ago. Because of all the poor Muslim people, primarily Muslim people, in France, they've come from previously colonized countries. The Maghreb countries like Tunisia and Algeria and Morocco, but also from Western Africa. And they've changed the complexion, both physically and mentally, of the countries. I think that's working against this homogenization, but it's not working the way most countries want it to work. I mean, if you look at the Netherlands, which has been traditionally a very liberal country, it's changed in the last year. With the assassination, especially of Theo van Gogh. He's related to Vincent van Gogh, who was really kind of a fascist, but he was doing a documentary about Muslims, and he was working with a Muslim woman, and he was assassinated. The Netherlands, even though he was an acclaimed fascist and hated Jews and spoke similarly about Jews and Muslims, he was martyred, in effect, in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands has been changing. It's been moving more toward being Afrikaans. You know, when you look at the Netherlands in the Netherlands, and then you look at the Netherlands in South Africa, you see two different people acting very differently. Afrikaans people don't really act like people in Amsterdam. Now, I think people in Amsterdam are just getting, they're nervous, they feel fed up, they feel a kind of anxiety they haven't felt before. And much of it, they think, is being generated by the emigration of poor Muslims into their country, who they feel, the Dutch feel, don't really have any regard for their country. They're just looking for a place to work. They don't try to assimilate or be integrated. And this is one of the problems that, you know, has been happening with the veil. It started in France first. Young women were told to remove their hijab or veil when they got into the lycée, when they got to high school age, and now we see the same thing in England, and we see it elsewhere in the Netherlands. And I think it's actually increasing some of the difficulties between Christian and Jew on the one hand and Muslim on the other. But the homogenization is also functioning. The world is moving toward a kind of a global village. It's not the global village that McLuhan talked about. It's something that contains, I think, a sort of toxic homogenization. It's moving away from differences, differentiation. People look the same on TV and so on. But there is this counter-movement, which has happened inadvertently. But airports are still homogenized, and increasingly so, mm-hmm. because poor people can't afford to travel in them, generally speaking.
Yeah, I'm still processing everything that you were speaking about because it's complicated and our world continues to get more and more complicated and I think what you're speaking about with the veil, it's been in the media a lot lately, and I've had a lot of conversations with friends about it and our it's just
what do you feel about that yourself, Crystal? The prohibition against young women wearing veils. Not talking about mm-hmm. women who are wearing the entire burqa, you know, and only their eyes are showing, but just wearing a veil over their face. Do you think that should be prohibited, or should it be up to the person herself whether she wants to wear it or not?
Yeah, I think it's an infringement on somebody's personal rights, and I absolutely think that it should be up to the individual that's wearing it. I'm sure you probably agree.
I do.
I'm assuming, so... Yeah, and it's really, among my particular circle of friends, we're all really pretty outraged that that has been the decision that a lot of European countries have begun to make, and it's worrisome that that might actually sometime influence the United States and some of their decisions about, you know.
Well, the United States has racial profiling going on. I mean, that's already in place. It was a surprise that France did this. Because France previously was proud of its history of allowing people to do what they want and dress the way they want and maintain their own culture within a culture. Now, so long as they speak French occasionally, but now it's very different. I think a lot of it is fear of Islam or radical Islam, and it's also a kind of convenient confusion of radical Islam, which really only includes a very, very small number of Islamic people and Islam overall. I think it's indicting, in effect, or by implication, the entire religion because of its fear of a very few number of people that are considered fanatical.
Mm-hmm. May I ask, how would you describe your politics?
Well, I think I describe myself as a Buddhist anarchist, and that seems a little bit contradictory, but I don't think absolutely. There's a school of Buddhism called Mahayana, which is very individual based, rather than Theravadic, which is more liturgical and more traditional. I think there's space in Mahayana Buddhism for an individual to go in different directions. So I would say that Buddhist anarchist, I don't like statism, whether it's capitalist or communist, or fascist. There's oddly a closeness among those three. I think totalitarianism, in a sense, speaks to all three of them. Now, to what extent Buddhist anarchism is viable overall, that's another question. But just describing my own inclinations, I'd say that's what they are.
Thank you for sharing that. In one of your earlier works, Guerrilla Writing, you suggest that an oppositional artist must know the interior of the country in order to, what you call, find a seam, plant a mine, and slip away. And I was wondering if you could explain this concept to our listeners.
You know, the idea that people have, particularly young people, because older people are already committed to the culture and aren't usually in position to change their lives. They have property, they have children in school, they have jobs they can't lose. But young people, when you ask them about the world, they always, particularly in America, express their hopelessness. What they say, in effect, is, what can I do? I'm 20 years old. I haven't had a chance to travel. I don't have much experience. Yes, I am against the suffering of poor people and the hierarchical base of this culture. But what can I do about it? That's where finding a seam comes in. I think seams, this network that we live in, this capitalist, institutional enclave that covers the entire United States and beyond, seems superficially not to have any openings. So it's hard to know where to go, how to penetrate in order to make an impact. The fact is that there are a lot of openings. You have to look for them. These are what I'm calling seams. I think these seams occur in virtual space, where young people have been getting into different sites in order to disrupt them, in order to perpetrate a kind of, let's call it, ethical disruption. I think it occurs in museums, where one could do a number of things. Even somebody who slashes paintings in museum, I think, though that person might be easily dismissed as crazy, I think even that has to be looked at. What is the point of elevating certain works of art and charging $30,000 for them when the artist who did those works, when he or she was alive, was given nothing for them? And was living in poverty. What does that elevation mean? Does it depend on the artist's death? Does it depend simply on the capitalist marketplace? So even doing something seemingly disruptive and anti artistic, like slashing a canvas, I think, and calling it art in a way. What, why is it much different than people who slash their canvases deliberately, than artists who slash their canvases deliberately? I think that's another way of entering that space. And then there are political ways of entering the space, although I wouldn't say that conventional politics is one of those ways. I think conventional politics, such as the Democrats winning the Congress, is good insofar as it probably means that fewer innocent people will be killed in Iraq. But for the long term and even the midterm, I don't think it's going to mean any significant changes. It's cyclical. I mean, that's the way the country works. That's the way most countries work. You know, 8 years of repressive politics and then 6 years of politics that are slightly less repressive, but still under the same aegis, A-E-G-I-S, under the same sort of pinnacle. So I think it's a question of looking for openings where you could do a kind of ethical disruption and then separating yourself from it, because I think the idea is to be strategic and to recognize that this is a dangerous world we live in, and innocent people could easily be jailed. They could lose their jobs. They could be persecuted in many ways, and are. And increasingly in our country as well. Mm-hmm. So you have to be alert and careful, and you have to pick your spots. But it's important that I emphasize ethical disruption. Although it could be argued, and I'm willing to listen to the argument for a kind of Dadaist disruption for the sake of disruption. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that might have some validity too. But that's a slightly different question.
And may I ask, what sort of minds are you planting in your latest book, Beyond the Techno Cave?
Well, one of them has to do with technology. I think technology certainly can function in our favor if it's a sort of intermediate technology. But what's happened is that technology now has become a kind of techno cult. There's no way to be outside it. You're either inside it or you're outside discourse. You're invisible in a sense, and to be inside it means to buy things, to access the products. If you want to look at a video, that means in many instances you have to look at an advertisement first. There's no alienation from it anymore. Alienation isn't really possible. So I wanted to look closely at that, and I cite a number of people, including even the so-called Unabomber, who's actually in the Unabomber Manifesto, has written intelligently about it in fair part. Not all of it is at the same level, but some of it I think is very good, but other writers have as well. So part of it has to do with humanizing, eroticizing, and toning down technology. So there are ways of living in this world which combine what used to be called actual time and virtual time, and virtual time doesn't utterly consume or subsume us as it's doing, for example, in airports. I think that's one thing I want to do. Another thing is to give a further voice to those people who have been rendered voiceless in our culture. In different ways, as when I talk about the artist Giacometti alongside the democratic imprisoned leader in Burma, Xu Chi. That's how her name is pronounced, S-U-U-K-W-I. And I'd like to get people to listen to her, because what she's done by separating herself from a family and allowing herself to be under house arrest in Burma has been an act of great courage. She wasn't even able to see her husband, who died of prostate cancer, and hasn't seen her children, her two boys, I think, in 7 or 8 or 9 years, simply because if she leaves Burma, she knows they won't let her back in. She's a Gandhian, she's very pacifist in her aims. If you asked me whether I was a pacifist, I'd have to give you a complicated answer, but she is pacifist. And I wanted to get people to pay close attention to her. And I aligned her with an artist that more people should know about, because he was a great artist, Giacometti, Swiss-Italian, though he lived and worked in Paris. And so neither of these people is absolutely voiceless, but they haven't been witnessed in the way, at least I feel, that they should be witnessed. So I think another reason for my writing this book was to continue to bear witness. I think that's what I feel that one of my foremost obligations is as a writer, to bear witness. And you might ask, if I want to bear witness, why don't I write journalism rather than this sometimes difficult work that I'm doing? Well, I don't think that difficult work is necessarily difficult to read, and that it's a condescension or it's a patronization of so-called ordinary people to feel that they can't read a so-called difficult work. I mean, ordinary people, so-called, read the Bible and they read the Quran, neither one of which is an easy read. They read these texts because they feel there might be something in them that could be useful to them. I'm not megalomaniacal about what I'm writing, and I don't feel that it can take its place next to the Quran and the Bible. But I do feel that the writer and the artist shouldn't patronize or condescend to ordinary people, but should write to them honestly and out of his or her feelings and sensibility, and give them the benefit of the doubt. I think if people are force-fed, McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, that's what their palate's going to want. If they're given a chance to respond to other kinds of nutrition, a nutrient, I think that there's a fair chance that they'll respond to that as well.
Thank you. And if you could have your readers take away one thing from your work, what would that be?
Well, what is it that you've taken away primarily, Crystal, if you were to think of one thing or two things? What have you taken away?
Well, off the top of my head, I would say, one, to not avert your eyes. And two, I would say to continue to try and write about difficult things and to research them, and I'm still processing what you just said about bearing witness and the importance of that, and I agree with you. I think that's absolutely important from a writer's perspective, so I am answering this question as a fellow writer. And I really just think that it's interesting that the way in which you bear witness to things that are going on within our country and within the world as a writer, so that was important to me. But I would still like to pose this question right back to you. What would you like your readers to take away?
Well, I don't think I could improve on your response, Crystal, honestly. Certainly to bear witness, and also to recognize that art can function in different ways. There's a notion, I think it's wrong-headed, and there are a lot of examples to the contrary, but it's still widely held that if you're writing socially activist art, it has to be written simply, sometimes even stupidly, dumbed down. And I feel that form and structure and technique can function as well. And again, it has to do with not patronizing people. So the idea of writing interestingly and aesthetically, and still writing pointedly and bearing witness, that together, I think is possible. And I'd like to think that I occasionally achieve that in the writing, whether it's conceptual or a different kind of work, which is using different sorts of structures and techniques. So I think on the aesthetic level, the idea of combining a penetrating look at what you consider, what one considers important in the world, with certain kinds of technical refinements and movements, of the text, which force the or encourage the reader's brain, to function in different ways, and encourage the reader to go to the corners of her sensibility and consciousness, to work with form, that is to say, and content together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for joining us in the studio. That was Hal Jaffe speaking on the behalf of his latest book, Beyond the Techno Cave, A Guerrilla Writer's Guide to Postmillennial Culture. I'm Crystal Malone, and you've been listening to Radioactive San Diego. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Hal, for being in the studio with us this evening.
I'm very happy to have been here.
Thanks.
Well, thanks, Crystal. I thought that was...